Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I was mulling this week about how we make cooking very complicated, and we don't have to. You know, the classics really work. Take salad dressing, a vinaigrette, oil, vinegar, salt, pepper. Yeah, I mean, toss a salad in that, but pour that over ribs and roast them. Amazing. Now take it a step further. Hang on to the oil, change the vinegar to balsamic vinegar, add wine and a little soy. Reduce that in a skillet with chunks of yams. Irresistible. Well, stay with us. There's more coming up this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com, turning your photos into works of art. Get your favorite photos on gallery canvas. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com/splendidtable to receive 50% off your canvas print.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, this week's show is about some of the new ways of getting into the kitchen with lots of help. First instance, columnist Melissa Clark has a fish supper you can do in maybe 15 minutes. We look at the upside of cooking for one. A Somali chef invites us into his kitchen, and we face one of the new challenges of our times, the food app. And just in case your life isn't complicated enough, now you can figure out which food app is going to work for you. Now, this is the job for a tech expert who cooks, and John Moe is here with us today. He hosts the Marketplace Tech Report and does some occasional cooking for his family. John, welcome.
You know, Lynn, the thing is, it's going to make your life easier. That's the thing. You figure out what the app is that you want to work with, and then that will ultimately be a time-saving device for you.
John, 100,000 apps?
Yeah, there's
and they don't
a lot
let
apps.
Me test drive them for a day? I mean, I've got to put up my 99 cents.
Sometimes 99 cents. Some of the ones we're talking about today, though, are actually free. So, you know, there's very little, unless you have a thing about looking at the occasional ad. You know, there's not much to invest in.
Well, what do you think of food apps at this point?
You know, there's good ones and there's bad ones. They're flooding all over the market. But you really read the reviews and read the buzz on what's going on about them. People are brutally honest, even about the ones that work well.
Yeah.
You know, the one that, as I kind of looked around at a bunch of things, the one that I became perhaps the most enamored of is this app called the Photo Cookbook, and it works on iPad. And what it is, you know, like I can't look at a recipe. I can't look at a bunch of words and imagine food coming out of that. I lack that imagination. In this one, you have beautiful photos on an iPad, which displays them really well.
Oh, yeah.
And so you look at these finished plates of food, and then you say, ooh, I want to eat that. And then you literally just point at it. You touch it with your finger, and it springs to life.
Really?
And then you get more photos of, okay, here's how much salmon you'll need. Here's a photo of the number of garlic cloves, professional photography. And then it takes you through the recipe, and it shows you along the way, here's what it should look like at this point. Here's what your sauce ought to look like at this point, so you can backtrack if something went
wrong.
This
sounds incredible, because that's what a great cooking class does.
Yes. It only has about 60 recipes on it so far, but Lynn, the neat thing about this app and about all apps is that they're dynamic. They get updated. You start with one thing. When these people come out with new recipes to add to it, they'll just pump more recipes into the app.
Well, that's great. Yeah. So a couple of more.
Okay. Ratio. And I know you've talked with...
the man who wrote the book, Michael Ruhlman.
Michael Ruhlman. Yeah. So Ratio exists as an app now. And the idea here is that you don't need a recipe if you have a ratio. And so it'll have on this app, for, under bread, for instance, you know, 5 parts flour, 3 parts water. And then you can change these ratios based on what you have. You might want to make a smaller loaf. You might want to expand some.
Right.
You might want to measure one ingredient in ounces and another in grams, and you can do that. And then so you can kind of sense your way through your own recipes if you're an adventurous type. And then it also has a tab on the app for details about how to prepare it, what to do right, what to do wrong, you know, what you can do.
This comes out of the guide that a lot of chefs use. It's literally one page, and it's all the ratios for sauces, for breads, for anything you make.
Yeah.
And once you've got that, you can make anything. So it's really, I think it's such a great idea that it's on an app. What's another favorite of yours?
There's an app called Fooducate. I think I'm pronouncing it right. Maybe it's Fooducate, but it's a combination of food and educate. So here's what you do. You have this app. You're running it on your phone. You go to a store. You go to a grocery store, and you think, maybe I want to buy Fruit Loops. You scan the UPC code with your phone. It gives you the straight dirt on what's really in this product.
Whoa.
Outside of the nutrition chart and all those ingredients that you can't quite comprehend.
Yeah, exactly.
Tells you, like, here's the fat in this. Here's the salt in this. Here's what you have going on. It's a bit of a health nut, this app, and so it'll also then turn around and say, why not have this similar product? It looks like this, and you know, it might satisfy the same thing, but it's a lot better for you, and it steers you over to that. It has, in the last update, and again, these get updated and mm-hmm. enhanced all the time, 200,000 unique UPC codes, so that when you go into a store, you know, you can fooducate yourself. You can figure
that
out what's going on.
That is the – it's a shortcut to yeah, I'm saying the obvious.
Yeah.
It sounds really great.
You know, this is what technology, and especially mobile technology, can do really, really well. It can give you detailed information that probably isn't available to the masses that you can really dig down and find.
John, this is gold. This is pure gold.
It's going to make your life easier. This is what I'm saying.
Okay. No, it's just the 100,000 number that kept getting to me. But now I have direction.
We got it down to 5 or 6.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. This is great. John, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
John Moe is the voice you hear on Marketplace Tech Report. Now, you're going to find his app picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And you'll find our recipe, almond chutney chicken in lettuce roll-ups. The recipe's on the site, splendidtable.org. A lot of times you have to be in the mood to cook. Now, I know what you're thinking. I'm never in the mood to cook. Ah, but you have not met up with Melissa Clark. A Good Appetite is the column that she does for the New York Times, and she has one. More to the point, her approach to cooking is so loose, it just could get to you. Well, Melissa joins us. Melissa?
Hello.
What are you loosening up these days?
Okay, one of the loosey-goosey things that I've been loving to cook lately is whole roasted fish. Lynn, I know you've roasted a whole fish before, but I feel like probably so many of your listeners haven't done it, and I just want people to get into their kitchens with a whole beautiful fish and pop it in the oven because it's so easy, and it is so much more delicious than cooking a fillet or a fish steak on its own.
But, you know, I think people are really scared of whole fish.
I think so, too. People are a little afraid of it just because they're not familiar with it. I mean, most of the time when you go to a restaurant and you order fish, you get a fillet or a steak on your plate, and you go to the fish store, and that's what you see in the case. You just don't see the whole fish as much, so they're just not as familiar. But if you seek them out, the thing about a whole fish is, first of all, you get a lot more flavor, because when you're cooking the fish on the bone and wrapped up in its skin, the flesh that's touching the bone and touching the skin is actually getting flavor from that. So it's a much richer taste. And another great thing about it is, especially if you're not used to buying fish, you can tell if a whole fish is fresh by looking it right in the eye. And that's something that you can't do with a fillet because the eye is cut off and so are the gills. So when you're buying a whole fish, you can really, you can trust that you're getting something that was right out of the water. And all you have to do is look for the brightness of the eye. It should be rounded, you know.
As opposed to flattened.
Exactly. If it's flattened and sunken, then it's a few days old. Also, the gills should be very red. And if you see that, then you have confidence. Oh, my goodness, this is a fresh fish. And the fresher the fish, the better it tastes. Now, of course, then the question is, what do you do with it, right?
Yes, yes, exactly.
So what do you do with your beautiful fresh fish that you've just got from the fish store? A rule of thumb for buying a fresh fish is, I like to buy individual fish for people. Everyone gets their own fish on a plate just because it's a little bit easier to serve for you. So you should probably buy a fish that's about a pound or a pound and a half, and that's going to serve one. So buy as many of those as you have guests. When you get it home, it's already been cleaned for you. All you have to do is give it a rinse, blot it dry with paper towels. And the thing about a whole fish is because it has so much flavor on its own, you don't need to do a lot. Salt, pepper, olive oil, and then whatever you're in the mood, whatever you have in your fridge. Do you like lemons and garlic? Throw them in the cavity of the fish. Just chop them up and throw them right in. Do you like olives and tomato? You feeling like something Mediterranean? Maybe a little basil? Throw it in the cavity of the fish. The cavity of the fish is where all your aromatics go. And then you take your fish that's been seasoned, you throw it in the oven on a baking sheet. The oven temperature doesn't even matter. Anywhere between 4 and 450. 450 gives you a little bit of a crispy skin. 400 makes it a little bit more velvety. And that's it. As soon as you start to smell the aromas of the fish, it's done. And then you can do a test for doneness is when you take it out, you look at the backbone of the fish, you put a little knife in there, and if it moves easily, it's perfect.
Now, wait, explain that again. The backbone of the fish...
The backbone of the fish, you take a thin bladed knife, you know, a little paring knife or even a fork, and you just go right, you just press, you know, put the tip of the knife right into the backbone. And if it's very hard to maneuver the knife in there, that means the flesh is not quite finished. You know, it's a little, if it's giving you resistance, if it slips right in easily, it's done. Now, what you're not looking for, people think, oh, the fish should flake. But you actually want to get it out of the oven a few minutes before it starts to flake, because the residual heat will continue to cook that fish from the time when you take it off the baking sheet to when you put it onto a plate. So that you're going to get about 2 or 3 minutes extra of residual cooking time. So you really want it to come out of the oven before that. And then once you've got it out of the oven, it doesn't need anything. It doesn't need a fancy sauce. All it needs is a squeeze of lemon and a little bit of olive oil, and you are in fishy heaven. It is so delicious, and it is so easy. And here's another trick for you, Lynn, because I know you love shortcuts, and I love shortcuts too. Don't grease your baking sheet. Take your fish, plop it right down on your baking sheet, and the side of the skin that's touching the baking sheet will stick to it in the oven. And that way, when you flip your fish over, the skin is already sticking to the baking sheet, so you don't have to take it off. It's just right there, and then you scoop the rest of that. The only bad part is you're going to have to soak that baking sheet probably for about an hour before you try to scrub off that fish skin.
Yeah,
but it's worth it because you're going to be eating your dinner. You're not going to care.
What a great idea. Hey, Melissa, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
I mentioned Melissa Clark writes for The New York Times, but she's got a book out too, In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite. Check out her video on roasting a whole fish on the website, SplendidTable.org. And while we're talking fish, have you ever tried roasting a fish in salt? Well, we did this for a party a while back when a friend came home from Spain with a ludicrous amount of sea salt. I blithely said, ooh, let's roast a whole fish. Well, a big fish in salt is a real showstopper at the table, and it's going to be the moistest fish that you're ever going to eat. Now, I am not going to go on about all the learning experiences here, except to say, before you buy your fish, be sure you measure your oven and your cookie sheet. You're going to roast the thing on a cookie sheet. Well, the basics here are you wet the salt so it's like damp sand, you pack it around the fish, and you roast away. Our 7-pound fish needed a mere 10 pounds of salt. Now, I've got a recipe up on the site for you, but one warning. We did this at our friend's house, and they report that they were vacuuming out their oven for 4 months after the dinner party. Well, we're going to be back with a visit to a Somali kitchen and the joy of cooking, for one. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Gasper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com. Take your favorite family photos, pictures of the kids, or those amazing vacation photos, and have them printed on gallery canvas like you might see in a museum. Starting at $19.99, you can have a beautiful gallery canvas print for your home or office. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com/splendidtable to receive 50% off your canvas print. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We recently took a trip to the Midtown Global Market in Minneapolis. Now, this is a bustling, wide-open space with restaurants and shops and food stands, and they represent just about everywhere. I mean, the Middle East, Mexico, India, Laos, Vietnam, Italy, and even local farmers. Now, in the midst of this is Safari Express. It's a Somalian food stand run by Jamal Hashi. The steam table is heaped with chicken and mango, roasted goat and spices, vegetable stews, and colorful sauces. Now, up on the menu board are things like bisbas and camel burgers. Well, we met up with Jamal in his small kitchen. Now, he's tall and slender, young, and he's got a great smile.
Welcome to my kitchen.
Thanks for having us. I see you have laid out here cinnamon sticks, bay leaves, and green cardamom pods. Are these very typical of Somalian spices?
Correct. Somalia is actually known for dry spices such as this. For over centuries, if you go to the ancient times, and the coast of Somalia was known for the Cape of Spices. And in the southern Somalia, we're facing the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
And since that ground was used to be a trading ground for all the merchants coming from east to west to south, we have tons of different influences. So when you think of Somalia, if we think about big flavors, we're not into bland food whatsoever. So you have to have that experience of explosiveness in your food. If you don't, people won't respect you at all in the community.
So really?
That is a fact.
A lot of chilies?
A lot of chilies, a lot of spices. In the hotter climates, in drier parts of Somalia, like southern Somalia, where Mogadishu is located, a lot of people eat not so much in the spicy, in the tent of burningness, but like spices in the sense of flavor.
So it's a backdrop to everything else.
That is correct.
So is there a lot of meat eaten in Somalia?
Yeah. See, this is why I say Somalia has so many different influences. There's a part in Somalia, in the western part, where they're known for the term ad i'ano, which translates into meat and milk. That's their main diet.
So what do you have on the menu here?
Well, that's the introduction of what Somali food is. It's not the whole...
That would be very hard.
A lot to cover. Yeah. And we border Kenya. So we have a lot of things that we share commonly with Kenya as well, which is a dish called ugali, which is a form of grits that's served with a spinach soup. It's a completely vegetarian dish as well. You can have meat sauces with it. It's a form of grits, and then you would have it for lunch or dinner. It's very starchy, very heavy. And we come from a culture of nomads. So when we eat food, we pack on pounds here because we're traveling for a distance. We're walking for miles and miles. So once we eat, we like to eat heavy and starchy food. And that's one of the main reasons why we eat that dish.
Yeah.
And the goat is another dish. I mean, that's if you love barbecue and if you're a meat eater, that mm-hmm. would be a dish that you would definitely have to try.
Tell me about you. When did you come to the United States and how did you come to cooking?
Well, it sort of chose me. When I was young, my father was... whenever we come home, he would always bring us a ton of meats and dishes, and he would be the first one up in the kitchen cooking all the dishes for us to sample, even though that was not his field. And growing up, I've seen a lot of crazy stuff coming from Africa.
Yeah.
We had a civil war in Somalia at the time. 2 years of my life I spent in a refugee camp in neighboring country, Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And later... came to the States, Fairfax County in Virginia, at the age of 11, and came to adjust to the society, and I guess in a way, it was a journey for me, coming to America, and this was an adventure for me, because I was so young at the time, I mean, I was excited at the fact that I'm coming to a new society where I have to learn a new language. You know, it was hard, of course, you know. But what prepped me for that was the camp that we went into, you know, the 2 years prior, before I came to the States.
In what way?
Well, I came from a life where everything was provided to me. You know, I had my mother home, my father home, and we were going to a private school. You know, we were wearing a uniform, having a chauffeur. And then all of a sudden, all that being taken away and having no mom, no dad, and living in a refugee camp, just me and my brother alone. So I had to adjust to that society of not having anyone, you know, providing to you. And so it prepped me for this. Coming to America was easy, the easy part.
You were reunited with your parents.
I was. Yeah. Yep. And that's, we came here together.
So how did the cooking come into it?
I always, you know, sort of cooked around the house.
Yeah.
You know, when we had Ramadan, which is, you know, the religious month.
Yes, where you fast.
The fast. And, yes. You know, and so whenever we would have that, it would be a privilege, actually, if my mother would ask me, or my brother, who's also a great, you know, chef as well, would invite us into the kitchen and say, hey, you guys want to partake in this? Lovely. We would jump right to it, and we would wait who would be the first that be asked.
Uh-huh.
So when I took it serious was in 2003, when my brother, who started a safari restaurant, and he invited me over and said, hey, let's make something together. And I would work in the kitchen during the evening. He would work in the kitchen during the daytime.
And are these all the family recipes?
Correct. These are all family recipe, and some that we add of our own too as well. But the thing I want to actually do for you here today, I want to surprise you, is the way I do my camel burger.
You're on.
Let's do it.
I have to say, it looks like ground beef.
Okay. The thing about camel meat is it's very, very, very lean. And the other fact was that nomads used to consume this, so they would travel long distances without settling down once they have the camel milk or the camel meat.
I really can't wait to taste this.
You know, the camel burger, it's a concept of my own. It hasn't been something that's been widely introduced to the Somali culture at all. The reason, the original reason why I decided to make the camel here was I wanted to introduce the meat in a friendly format to the Americans.
Right.
What better way to put it in a bun? There we go.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, wow. Mmm. That is utterly delicious. You realize, Jamal, that if this takes off, there are going to be camels raised in Minnesota.
In Minnesota.
This is wonderful. Jamal, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for coming into my kitchen today. I'm glad to host you here anytime.
Well, it's been our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
You can find Jamal Hashi at his food stand, Safari Express. It's in the Minneapolis Global Marketplace. Definitely worth the trip. Now, find a version of Jamal's spicy coriander and lime sauce. It's called Bizbaz on the website splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern's specialty is finding the places that locals always go to eat, but visitors rarely find. You know, the places you love to brag about when you come back from a trip. Well, of course, they blow the bragging rights because they tell all on their road food site. And here. Hey, Jane, Michael, what's the latest, guys?
Lynn, we have been studying a subcategory of breakfast meats.
I beg your pardon.
And Michael, you sound so professorial.
Well, I would call this cuisine maudite. In other words, if you're French, a kind of accursed cuisine that people who love it absolutely adore it. People who did not grow up eating it find it rather strange or possibly even repulsive.
And that would be me.
Including Jane. Well, in this category, you know, not too long ago, Lynn, we talked to you about geta, which is very popular in Cincinnati.
Right.
Which is the pork and pin oat loaf that sometimes is a breakfast meat. There are other ones, like scrapple is very popular throughout the mid-Atlantic states. If you grow up eating scrapple, you love it. A lot of people think, ooh, I don't think I want to have scrapple.
And then there's liver mush.
There's liver mush. There's liver pudding. I mean, these are all foods that If you grew up eating, you love. Well, the ultimate such food, and if you grew up in New Jersey, I got to say, you have to know about this because it's really popular in all the diners of New Jersey, is something known as pork roll.
To ring Wait, a bell? Hold it. I grew up in New Jersey. I don't have a clue of what you're talking about.
Were you raised in a convent, Lynn?
Oh, Michael.
Or a kosher
Never
home?
In a million years, Michael. But pork roll. What
pork
is it?
Pork roll.
What is it?
Well, nobody knows quite what it is. It originally was marketed as Taylor ham because the guy who invented it was John Taylor.
Oh.
This is back in the Civil War. Not John Martin Taylor.
The southern food
Not
person.
The southern food guy.
Okay.
Taylor ham, he called it Taylor ham until the government decided it did not meet the qualification to be called ham.
In other words, it had no pig in it.
It had no actual ham in it. It had other pig parts. Anyway, it's kind of like a big roll of bologna. And it's sliced thin and fried. And, of course, to fry it, once you slice it thin, you've got to put little – you have to scar the edges so it doesn't curl up like a cup on the griddle. And what you do is to put this pork roll in a sandwich along with egg and cheese. And this is known in New Jersey diner slang as a triple bypass. Well, I have to tell you, one single slice of pork roll supplies 26% of the fat recommended in a normal daily diet.
Are they going to say recommended in a lifetime?
That may be. But let me tell you, people who grew up in New Jersey just find this the most amazing, wonderful food. People get nostalgic for it, have it shipped into wherever they live.
This is all news to me. I'm utterly fascinated. All right, but where do you go? Obviously, you guys have a place you really like for this or a couple
Our
of places,
Our secret
right?
pork roll emporium.
Well,
yes,
I would,
exactly.
Oh, virtually any diner has it. I would recommend going to the TikTok Diner in Clifton, New Jersey, where the motto on the sign outside is "Eat Heavy,"
which is a perfect motto if you're about to eat.
No, but the reason I would recommend going to the TikTok Diner is that it is one of those diners with a vast and gigantic menu where you can find, you know, 82 different kinds of breakfast. So if by some chance you don't want to sample pork roll, you can have a Greek omelet, you can have a vegetarian special, you can even have vegan specials there. It's one of those diners with around-the-world menu.
Vegan pork rolls.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Au revoir, Lynn.
Oh, au revoir, Michael. The Stern's latest work is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can get their finds of the moment on our site, splendidtable.org. Joe Yonan is food and travel editor of The Washington Post. Now, according to him, 31 million of us live alone. Well, this begs the question, why do recipes always serve 4 or 6 or even 8? Well, I suspect it's because cooking for one and eating alone are supposed to be so bleak. Well, Joe disagrees, big time. He champions eating alone. And his new book is Serve Yourself, Adventures in Cooking for One. So, Joe's here. Joe, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Lynn. Glad to be here.
So why do you think it's so hard for us to cook for ourselves and eat alone?
You know, when I tell people what I've been working on, usually the first thing that someone says is, oh, why would I bother to make that for myself? Why would I bother to do all of that just for myself? And my immediate reaction always is, well, why wouldn't you? I don't know. I just think that I am the most important person to feed that I can think of. So that's something that people seem to just have a block about sometimes, is they're so used to this idea that food is meant to be shared that they can't imagine it any other way. And I love sharing food with people, but several nights a week, you know, I got to eat, and I'll be damned if I'm not going to try and make something interesting for myself.
Well, this brings me to the other important thing. What do you have in your pantry? What should? What are some of the basics if we're going to give this a shot? What do we need?
Oh, you know, my favorite, really my all-time favorite pantry item are dried beans. And I just think that if you're trying to eat healthily and you're cooking for yourself and maybe you're even on a budget, you got to learn how to make beans from scratch. And beans freeze so well. So on really almost every weekend, I put a pot of beans on. And then I freeze them. I freeze them in Ziploc bags or little containers. And then I have them to pull out and either refry, which is one of my favorite things on earth, or drain and throw into salads or stir fries. I also am a huge fan of all sorts of oils and also vinegars. You know, the options for salads, if you've got an interesting selection of vinegars and oils in your pantry, is sort of, you know, exponentially raised. So that's another thing. I'm addicted to all sorts of Asian condiments. I can't live without fish sauce. Anytime I'm making some dish and I taste it and it doesn't taste deep enough, a couple glugs of fish sauce usually solves that problem.
That is a trick that, you know, everybody should have up their sleeve, just a few drops, even though it smells like old socks.
It does.
So give me some examples of some of the favorite things you love to make for yourself.
I'm a huge, huge fan of tacos, Lynn. I have a recipe for what I call pastoral tacos. They're sort of a play on tacos al pastor, you know, those wonderful pork on a spit tacos in Mexico that they combine with pineapple that's sitting
on you get little shreds of marinated pork on a corn taco, and you get the onions and the pineapple
and
the cilantro. Oh boy, yeah.
So great. And you know, when you go to one of those taquerias, the guy, he reaches up with his knife and just slices. He's holding the tortilla in his left hand, and he just slices the pork with his right, and it just falls onto the tortilla. And then he reaches higher and slices the pineapple off the top, and he catches that in the tortilla too.
Right, yeah.
So I have a sort of a take on that. It actually uses a thinly pounded pork cutlet that you quickly marinate in pineapple. It sort of does its magic while you're making a quick salsa with the flesh of the pineapple. And then quickly pan fried and use that in tacos. And I love that. I put pickled onions on tacos as often as I possibly can.
You're a condiment collector, aren't you?
I am. I sort of feel like if you have the right powerfully flavored, deeply flavored condiments in your fridge that you've taken the time to make when you have a little more time, then, you know, you come home and it's pretty quick to throw some stuff together. You know, one of my favorite tacos is a taco recipe that uses sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are another one of my favorite go-to ingredients. And it's simply roasted sweet potatoes. And if you don't have time, you can do it in the microwave. Fried egg, a salsa that I love to make that I call blackened salsa that's quickly broiled and then pureed with vinegar and oil. It's tomatoes and garlic and shallots, jalapeno, broiled black, and then pureed, and then pickled onions. So on the taco, you just slice up the sweet potato, you top it with a fried egg, a little bit of the salsa, and the pickled onion. And those are all things that I have in my refrigerator almost any given day of the week. So that's a go-to for me.
Well, I know you like to eat alone, but I'm going to come to your house as soon as I get to D.C.
These recipes are so easy to double, Lynn.
Hey, Joe, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Joe Yonan's testimonial to cooking for only you is Serve Yourself, Adventures in Cooking for One. Now, you can channel one of Mexico's great street foods with Joe's recipe for pastoral tacos. Well, you know where it is. It's on the website. SplendidTable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, why is Friday the 13th an unexpected gift to any of us who've ever known culinary failure? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, but first I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, why is Friday the 13th an unexpected gift to any of us who have known culinary failure? Well, the answer is Friday the 13th has another title. It is officially Blame Someone Else Day. Now, unfortunately, this only applies to the first Friday the 13th of the year. But look, we can cash in. I mean, this is where you get an excuse to blame any disaster that's happened in your kitchen on somebody else. For instance, blame salt manufacturers who make salt look exactly like sugar. That's for when the whole office chokes on your chocolate chip cookies. Blame your oven for mysteriously flipping into the cleaning mode and turning $50 worth of beef into one large charcoal briquette. And then blame those stupid recipe writers who don't tell you that they do not mean for you to toss the ingredients together literally. Well, doesn't that make you feel better? The lines are open. We're taking your calls at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Remember, anything goes. We have Mary calling from Bordeaux, France. Mary, I hope you're opening a bottle of wine as we speak.
Hi, Lynn. Probably will be in a little bit later, but not yet.
All right.
I'm calling to ask about scallions. I have a lot of recipes that call for scallions, American recipes.
Right.
And I can't, or at least the vast majority of the time here, I can't find anything in France that looks like a scallion.
Right.
And I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be using then in a recipe, what I could use to substitute to give the same kind of flavor. For a while, I was using, they have it in my markets, they have white onions that are sold in bunches.
Right.
But the bulbs, the white part is a lot bigger. And then I had read in some places that you could use leeks for scallions. But our leeks here are a lot bigger than...
Yeah, and you can't use leeks raw, whereas scallions you can use raw. Well, basically, this is the thing about scallions, and in much of Europe, is that they don't really show up until spring,
mm-hmm.
and they're there for a really short time. It's the seasonal thing, but those bunches of onions, and I think what you're referring to, I think they're sometimes called ciboulette, I'm not sure, but they're green-stalked young onions, and,
mm-hmm.
and the base is bigger than a scallion. But you could use those, and you could use the whitish part of the stem and then the green top.
Mm-hmm. I've gotten used to adapting to the seasons here much more than I did back in the States, but the scallions are something where it's really a matter of a week or two where I see them.
That's right. I had the same experience when I was living in Belgium, and it was dismaying because at that time I was writing a lot for magazines where you're working 6 months ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to do a spring article in the middle of the fall.
Right.
You're saying to people, you know, little onions, and they're looking at you like, yeah, right, April, you know, hello.
Yeah.
So, but you can use those fresh pulled onions when you can't get the scallions. And the other thing is you can use a mild onion. You know, in the dead of winter when there's nothing out there that's fresh pulled, use a really mild onion.
Right.
Yeah. Enjoy Bordeaux, and I hope this helps you out.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye. Now, by the way, when you get an onion that's really hot and really strong, there's two ways that you can tame it down. I use this whenever I want to put an onion in salads, especially, or use it raw, okay? The first one is slice up the onion however you're going to slice it and put it in ice water for about a half hour. You could leave it there overnight. It gets really crisp and all that heat gets leached out of it. The other thing that you can do is cover it with some kind of acid. So it could be lemon juice, vinegar, grapefruit juice, you know, anything, right? The onion goes limp, but it actually almost turns sweet, which is pretty amazing. And if you're really in a hurry, you don't have 20 minutes or 30 minutes to let it just marinate in that, stick it in the microwave for about 2 minutes. Yeah, the onions get limp, but they take on a nice taste, and they're not going to be sharp. You can call us 800-537-5252. 5252. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Lisa's on the phone from Lexington, Kentucky. Lisa, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. I really love this show.
So, well, thank you.
I have a share of a CSA. Well, I had it over the summer, and I plan to do it again this summer. And I have these really great sliced white turnips that I sliced pretty thin and I froze.
Ooh.
And I'm just wondering, what should I do with them? They were pretty mild. They were sweet and crunchy. And I'm thinking like an au gratin or something.
Well, you could do an au gratin easily, you know, just butter or use olive oil in, you know, in a shallow baking dish and layer them in, you know, overlap them like little scallops and dust them with a fair amount of nutmeg and black pepper and salt and maybe, you know, stick some slices of garlic between the slices. And then you pour milk or half and half over that and you cover it with foil and you bake them until they're really tender. And then if you want, you can shred up some really good imported Gruyere or forget the import, a local cheese that you really like. Not too strong. Okay. And just run that into the oven until it melts. And it is gooey, ooey, wonderful. Yeah. You know, the other thing that's wonderful, because people don't realize how sweet turnips are. And, you know, turnips show up in the spring, too. So you're not really out of season. One thing is they're wonderful with things like salmon, roast lamb. If you're roasting, let's say, a chicken, you can butterfly it, put it in a shallow pan, you know, like a half sheet pan, and then scatter these with red onion that's sliced all over the pan, and then pour some olive oil over the chicken and the vegetables and some salt and pepper and put some fresh herbs in there.
Yeah.
And maybe, I don't know, a tad of wine. Couldn't hurt. And salt and pepper, and roast it at about 350. Keep basting the chicken with the pan juices and baste the turnips and the onions. I mean, that would be wonderful. Yeah.
That would be good. I actually don't eat meat, but I can make that for a family member.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be meat. I mean, it could be anything. Yeah. In fact, how about this? I've got an idea for you. How about you do them as a puree? This is a trick. I love this. You've already got them sliced fairly thin, right? Okay, so you don't have to do a parboil. The idea is that you take a big skillet, you put a little bit of oil in it, and you put some kind of vegetable broth or even water in there. You put in about 10, 15, 20 cloves of garlic that you've just smashed. You put in some onion sliced up, and you put in a couple of pounds of those turnips. And you cover it and just let it simmer until the turnips are falling apart. Take the cover off and boil off just about all of the liquid. Now, cool them down a bit, put them in a food processor, drizzle it with olive oil, give it the nutmeg and the salt and the pepper and puree. This is heaven.
That sounds great.
It is delicious. Now, if I were you, I would feature turnips nonstop for the next 2 or 3 weeks.
They were amazing. I mean, I would just eat them like apples. Like they just tasted so good. And I had too many of them and I couldn't eat them fast enough. So this is great. Thank you so much for
these ideas. I think you're going to like it. You know, we saw through the fall and the early winter, yellow turnips coming into the market and they were sweet like that. They were just wonderful. So, you're so lucky to get great turnips. See now?
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. The larder will be empty and you'll be primed to start stocking up on the next CSA season.
Yes, I can't wait.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Marcy is on the phone from Alton, Illinois. Marcy, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. My friend Jennifer and I are volunteers for organization called Partners for Pets, and we are looking to have a fundraiser at this year's Collinsville International Horseradish Festival in June.
A horseradish festival?
Yes. Collinsville produces approximately 60% of the world's horseradish supply.
Where is Collinsville?
It's down in the kind of the western part, just not too far from St. Louis, actually.
Really? Mm-hmm. And is horseradish being graded on the spot? Are people having contests with horseradish recipes?
Yes, they do. And they have a two-day festival. There's arts and crafts and food vendors and...
this sounds great.
All kinds of things that you can come and do.
So I gather you called with a question.
Yes. We are looking to have a fundraiser, and we want to be able to provide baked goods with horseradish as an ingredient.
What a great idea. Okay, let's think now. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is, because horseradish and anything creamy is a natural, right?
Mm-hmm.
What about a quiche-style deal?
A quiche?
Yeah. I mean, would that fit, or are you thinking only sweet?
Not necessarily sweet. We're looking at desserts or bread items, anything really that's kind of novel that would have horseradish in it.
Because what I was thinking was, you know, a basic quiche, which is half and half or milk with eggs, cheese, and some kind of either vegetable or meat or whatever. And I'm thinking about how delicious horseradish is if you have a little sour cream in that mixture, so you have a tang, and you've marinated, you know, grated horseradish in lemon or in vinegar and sugar.
Wow.
And then fry up really good bacon. Drain it well on paper towel so you've got a lot of crisp bacon pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And you make your custard, do your crust. You can take any quiche recipe and adapt it to this.
Right.
Okay? Make your crust. Make the custard. Grate up some cheese, all right? Put into the custard. I'd put the custard in a food processor, and I would add to it some cream cheese and then sour cream as well. So you want that tang.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you do is you put lots of crisp, well-drained, so it's not super greasy, bacon on the bottom of the quiche, and you put a bit of that horseradish that's been in a sweet, sour marinade. You drain it and pat it dry, and then you pour in that custard. And it's like
a
horseradish bacon savory cheesecake.
That'd be great.
And you can call it anything you want. I mean, make up a name that's wonderful. You know, the Collinsville Revenge or something like that. It's just... Now, as far as sweet goes, you can pickle horseradish. You can put it in sugar and cure it. That real zing that it has will probably still be there. But I would toss thin sliced or grated horseradish with sugar and a little bit of acid, a little bit of vinegar, and let it sit overnight. And then I would fold that mixture into something like a chocolate cake, a chocolate pound cake. Because I think, this is guesswork, obviously I've never worked much with horseradish desserts, but I think that if you get it saturated with sugar, you're going to get a really amazing combination of tastes and a really good dark chocolate cake. It'll just set it off. And you know what would be good with it? You know what would be good with it? Some dried sour cherries in that cake. I'm just thinking tart on tart. So there's two thoughts. There's two thoughts. And that cake could be cupcakes, you know, little finger cupcakes. But
well, I appreciate the ideas.
Well, you are welcome, ma'am, and very good luck with the Horseradish Festival. May you raise a ton of money, and may the festival be a wild success.
Well, thank you.
You take
care.
Thank
you very much.
Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Shauna calling from San Francisco. Shauna, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Rustic Italian desserts.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I figured you'd be my go-to girl, Lynn.
I you know, maybe just.
So here's the thing. I'm a baking blogger. I have a blog piece of cake. So I'm always looking for inspiration.
Right.
And lately, I've been really into this idea of rustic Italian desserts, the sort of thing that's just so delicious in its simplicity, right?
Right.
So I've been doing a lot of panna cottas. Your farmhouse panna cotta is the best.
Thank you. And I'm blushing now, but thank you very much.
It's great. So I was wondering if you had any other ideas for recipes I might try with that same kind of vibe, like maybe a cake or something like that.
Well, I have to tell you, there's a couple of things that you see so much. And, you know, a lot of Italians don't make many desserts because you buy the desserts. But one of the things you see a lot, and you've probably done this, is called a crostata. And we would call it a tart. And the idea is that you make a sweet crust. In Italy, it's called pasta frolla, but it's really a sweet pie crust. And I like to make it so there are still some big chunks of butter in it, so it's flaky.
Right.
You roll this out. You roll it out a little thicker than you might normally do it. You might put it on a cookie sheet. You might put it in a round tart pan. And you put an edge on it, you know, so you roll it out so that you have a little rise, a rim around it. And then par bake that.
Right.
You know, line it with foil, put some weights on it, and bake it at 400 for 8 to 10 minutes just to firm it up. And then what you do is whatever fruit you have. You slice into that, and you don't want to crowd it. This is not a pie. It's a tart where the crust is going to be as important as the fruit. But for instance, this time of year, you might use apples and green grapes or pears with red grapes, really wonderful. And you scatter that fruit over the crust. Give it even a little space between slices, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, sprinkle it with fresh rosemary.
Oh.
Yeah, gotcha, didn't I? Grate some black pepper over that. Sprinkle it with a little olive oil instead of butter. And then with a generous amount of sugar.
Oh, my God.
And if you want it, some cinnamon. The combination goes back to maybe the 14th, 15th, 16th century.
Right.
It still works. Bake that at about 400 degrees. So you want to have the fruit caramelizing. It is so easy. It is so delicious. And there's nothing to it because you use whatever you've got.
That sounds spectacular. That combination is, do you know, I had a rosemary bush in my backyard for a year and didn't realize it was back there.
You live in San Francisco, and I know in your part of the world, rosemary is considered a decorative ground cover.
It is. It is. It's everywhere. And we had one in the back, and my husband was cleaning up the lawn and smell all this rosemary, and he's like, yeah, it's this bush back there. I'm like, what?
I know. You know, I'm sorry. I have no patience with you guys in California. You know, you talk about living with the seasons. Come on, give me a break.
I know. We really don't have any.
Yeah, I have a rosemary plant that is sitting on my windowsill gasping for sunlight.
Poor thing.
Hey, this was great because, you know, I think maybe other people are going to maybe give this a shot too.
Oh, it sounds awesome. Thank you so much.
Hey, you are welcome. Have a great one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Mark Twain, who said, "In the spring, I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 24 hours." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Holacek. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.